escorting us home.
And finally, London-based Shamsi, a pro-Saudi Salafist preacher who appeared on a podcast with Faraz Hamadi, mocking those who have called for boycotting Starbucks in solidarity with the people of Gaza and deflecting with claims about social media links to Zionism.
There are, of course, big multi-million dollar companies like Starbucks and McDonald's and other kind of names.
You know, I love Starbucks, you know. People are driving me crazy. Starbucks. I'm going to hide it.
I don't drink Starbucks, by the way, but you're drinking Starbucks, right? Yeah. I saw some of your videos, you're holding the cup. I'm like, man, this guy's going to get a lot of heat now.
You don't understand. You know, I'll tell you this funny story, yeah? Someone sent me a message on Instagram, and he said to me, Akhi, do you know that Starbucks is a Zionist supporter? I said, okay. I said, do you know that Instagram, the owner of Instagram, is a Zionist supporter? Yeah.
These men and many other influencers like them belong to a wing of Salafism referred to sometimes disparagingly as Madkhalism. One core tenet is that Muslims must always obey their leaders, a concept that is generally accepted by some Muslims, but for those influencers, there don't appear to be any particular conditions as to when disobeying those rulers should be prioritized, such as when those leaders are collaborating with Israel.
Joining us today to talk these issues through are two esteemed guests and favourites of the show. With me in the studio is Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who is one of our few honourable scholars that is unapologetic in his Islamic duty of condemning the oppression in Palestine. He graduated from the Islamic Seminary in Qum and lectures in the UK. And joining us on Skype is Brother Shakil Afsar from Birmingham. Shakil is a prominent Kashmiri activist who has tirelessly campaigned against Islamophobia in the UK and abroad, and has consistently championed the Palestinian cause in the mainstream. Thank you to you both for joining us. Sheikh, if I can come first and foremost to you. I don't know how you felt watching, you know, that VT. That was, it made me angry. But as a scholar, you know, what are the responsibilities of Muslim scholars in times of oppression? We saw that, masalan, these people were saying that we should avoid boycotting. You know, specifically, is that something that Muslim scholars have the right to say or do?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the time of oppression, in the time of the extremes of oppression, like what we are seeing in Gaza right now, the duty of Muslim scholars is to provide clarification, understanding to the people of why this is happening, what are the forces behind it, you know, who are on what side, and what role should we play in this. I think a lot of people tend to have a very limited idea of what the Muslim scholars who are the leaders of our society should do. They think they should only be providing, spiritual services, but not be involved in the issues of community empowerment, consolidation, and guidance in terms of how to face the challenges that are presented to their societies. And this is one of the challenges that is being presented to our society, and we can judge them by their response.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. You know, judging these kind of scholars, just as we saw earlier, Shakil, if I can come to you, as we saw earlier in the show, you know, there are some Muslim scholars who have taken an approach that some would call disappointing, some would call treacherous. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. At a time when a lot of British Muslims don't actually know what to do and they are at wit's end, we have scholars saying that we shouldn't be boycotting. We have scholars saying that we should be listening to Muslim leaders. The question I have for these Muslim scholars, or so-called scholars I would call them, is what are the Muslim leaders actually doing? Do they not see the videos that are coming out of Palestine? Do they not see the young innocent children? If British Kashmiris, American Kashmir Muslims, if Muslims all over the world want to boycott because they feel that is the only weapon they have, why are people pushing them away from this? Maybe those scholars are on the payroll of the oppressors. You know, a lot of times people will tell and misguide the community to serve their own pockets. And, you know, I firmly believe that people like these scholars who, for whatever reason, I'm not a scholar myself, and I have never, you know, claimed to be one, but what I do suggest is, why are these people pushing away, you know, people who stand by Palestinians from wanting to do something? You know, they're saying we must listen to the Muslim governments, but every single one of you can see, what are the Muslim governments really doing? We have Muslim superpowers who have nuclear power, and they are sat on the fence. You know, I firmly believe at the end, when this is all said and done, we won't remember the oppression of our oppressors, but we will really remember the silence of our friends.
Really well said. You know, I remember reading a statistic to say that all the Muslim countries in the world, they occupy, you know, a sixth of the world's wealth, if not more. And they could not get a drop of water into Gaza. They have not yet done anything to actively, really, on the ground, make an impact on the genocide that's going on. And just as Shakil said, Sheikh, you know, some Muslim leaders are, or Muslim scholars, preachers, are actually thinking about their own pocket, because they are getting some money for their stances, let's say. But religiously, and the question to you is, religiously, are there any justifications for Muslims to stay silent when it comes to oppression?
No, and I think that goes against the statement by the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he said, when a Muslim is confronted with a wrongdoing, this is, he's a Muslim, he didn't say the Muslim ulama, okay? When they're confronted with a wrongdoing, they should change it with their hands. You know, meaning that if you have the power, for example, the political power, the economic power, you see, to be able to actively change that, then you should do that. And if you cannot do this, then you should speak out against it with your tongue. You know, and speaking out against it with our tongues include things like demonstrations, for example. You know, chants, slogans, analyses, historical approaches to these types of things. And if you cannot do this, which means that the situation is so repressive, you know, that just speaking out with the tongue is dangerous to you, can get you killed, you know, then you hate it in your heart. And hating it in your heart, hating that wrongdoing in your heart, is the least of iman. In other words, if you had 1 ounce of iman, you know, you should be able to hate oppression. At any rate, at this point in time, we don't have that intense oppression over speech yet to say that we cannot speak out, you see? And so when people talk about, you know, only the scholars have the right to say this and the scholars have the right to say that, or the quote-unquote leaders, I don't know what they mean by this amorphous term, leaders, all right? What is this actually denying us is agency, you see? Because that hadith, it applies to all Muslims, you know? Not that, you know, you just have to follow your leader for you to decide to take action.
Yes, absolutely, Sheikh. And you know, the Muhammadi spirit is clear. It encourages the good and forbids the evil. But some believe that this is a personal endeavor not to be mixed in with politics. We went to the streets of London to ask Muslims about what they expect from religious leadership during times of war, and in this case, genocide.
We need to see calls for action made against this vile, genocidal Israeli entity. So what we want to see from our speakers, we want to see calls for boycotting, we want to see pressure being put on these members of parliament, we want to see anything that can be done to aid our brothers and sisters in Gaza and Palestine, anything that can be done, we want to see it being done. So anyone who has a voice and has been silent on this matter, just understand that the community is not going to forget this.
Whether like very political or like just, you know, the social media scholars as we know them, we've seen them there from the start, and then 7 October onwards we saw them, you know, even come out more. And you know, I think every day their stories, their feed is just about Palestine, and they've been teaching us how to talk more, how to advocate more. boycotting, the role of, like, you know, to keep this going, to keep talking about it.
I think, like, for example, the other day, Sayyid Sistani put, I don't know if you saw it, on Karbala, on Imam al-Abbas grave, alayhi salam, he put, like, a big poster that it's wajib to boycott and stuff. Like, as much as you can, because obviously you can never boycott everything, but as much as you can, you know, if you go to a supermarket, you see cola on the fridge, you don't buy it.
We should not stop. The protests should not stop. We should not stop speaking about it. Everyone that has a platform, you have 2 followers, 3 followers, 5 followers, everyone needs to speak, push it forward. You meet someone in a cafeteria, speak to them, see what they're saying, teach them. And another thing that I think is very important is when we are going to the protests, is that we understand, I'm talking especially to the Muslims, is for us to stick and stick to the Quran and Sunnah and the Sharia, that we don't, you know, do things that go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has told us to do.
Shakil, if I can come to you in this question. In the West, many scholars have stayed silent. Do you think that this exposes where people's loyalties lie? You did, you know, briefly in your previous answer, talk about their pockets aligned. You know, can you go into a bit more detail about that?
Well, look, I can say, and credit where credit is due, some of these Muslim institutions, some of these scholars, unfortunately, are silent because of the pressures that exist. So I totally understand that these institutions have been set up to push forward the message of Islam, to allow people to pray, allow people to congregate in prayer. But what these institutions must understand, we understand the pressures that they face by the British establishment. But at this current time, it is time that they face these pressures head on, and the communities will stand with them. A lot of, you know, institutions, a lot of massages, a lot of trusts that have been set up, their answer to not speaking is, we do not want to have our masjids closed down. We do not want to have, you know, external reviews happening on what's happening internally. But I say to each and every single one of them that if now is not the time to face our problems, then when is? If these institutions cannot be the pillars of our community and leave the communities to stand for the Palestinians, then who will? We have so many people within Birmingham who are actually going through PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And this violent situation hasn't even finished yet because of the sheer fact of the, you know, the videos that are coming out, the horrific scenes that we are seeing. If our ulama, if our imams, if our institutions are not going to give direction to the Muslims, who is?
Excellent question. Excellent point, pardon me, that you've made there. If they're not actually going to be doing their job, if they're not going to be leading the Muslim Ummah, you know, acts of acting, as you mentioned, in encouraging the good and forbidding the evil is iman, it is faith. And if people are going to be discouraging them from that, people like Mehdi Mudarrisi and Ammar Nakhchiwani, who have in the past diverted people's attention from their support of Palestine, quelling in their rhetoric, in their language, quelling the thirst of the people for change through activism, and even profiting off of this genocide through putting some of their lectures behind a paywall, Sheikh. Like, it beggars belief. What would be your response to this kind of leadership?
Well, you know, I think when leadership abandons its responsibility, that vacuum must be naturally filled. And when I say must be naturally filled, I mean the leadership will come from somewhere else. You see? And this is what we would call maybe revolt or rebellion. So, for example, in this issue of Palestine and what's happening in Gaza, you would find that if, for example, a particular establishment or particular individuals who might be prominent in the society and so forth do not provide the guidance that is necessary to respond to this, which goes back to these three modes, okay? Boycotting means action, the power that we have. You see, when they do not fulfill these three modes, then what happens is you would find the youth, the younger generation, others who see that flaw, you know, who will fill that gap. And this is exactly what is happening with the Gaza issue. You know, not only in the Muslim community, but also in the non-Muslim community. Yeah. All right? You find that the the democratic force of people on the street, you know, results in not only the fall in Joe Biden's approval ratings, but also it results in the fall in the approval ratings of our the people we consider to be our leaders, okay, who are also not responding to that.
Because what they're doing is exactly the same.
Exactly.
There's no longer a distinction between the religious and the non-religious leadership because their stances are exactly the same.
Exactly. And this is where now we, or the community who see that gap, you know, need to fill, and this is what is happening.
Okay, well then, on the, in the inverse, what about the scholars who have stepped up? You know, we've got Masalan Sheikh Asra Rashid, we've got Dr. Abdul Wahid, you know, people like, and I'll come to you, Shaquille, about this question too. But, you know, what about those people? You've got Masalan Sheikh Azhar, Hussein Makki, and all these other, you know, prominent young scholars. What about their example?
Well, I think their example is an example to be followed. I think that they are showing the true leadership in the community. You know, and I think people should be aware of that and should reward them by gathering around them and supporting them, you know, and interacting with them. Mm. Yes. And I don't think, you know, I mean, we're in a time right now where, for example, you have to follow your leaders unquestioningly. This is the 21st century. You know what I mean? There is self-criticism, you know, which is something very important. Our leaders could come up short in areas, and they should be open to criticism of others in order to improve themselves, just like we as ordinary people as well should do.
And Shaquille, if I can ask you the similar question, you know, what about scholars who have stepped up? What examples do you have of these scholars? Is there a generational gap, it seems? You know, we're seeing that a lot of young scholars, you know, in their 30s who are kind of coming out of these seminaries, they are saying what we believe, what the people can see, whereas older generation of scholars are kind of, you know, more with the establishment, generally.
Yeah, I absolutely have to agree. Namely, Brother Sheikh Asrar Rashid is actually very local to myself. And like the Sheikh in the studio just said, it's the 21st century. So the more younger scholars are actually stepping up because they are basing things on factual evidence. They are actually in touch with their community. They are liaising with their community. And they are being the pillars of society that they need to be. Unfortunately, with some institutions and some individuals, they seem to be more worried about and concerned about protecting their institution when, in fact, they are actually destroying their institution because the communities can see their silence. The communities can see that these people are completely silent on the plight of our people, whether it be the Palestinians, whether it be the Kashmiris, or whether it be any Muslims all over. So I definitely, definitely agree with the Sheikh that in the 21st century, and this is a big, there's a big movement that is taking place. And unfortunately, there will be a time when those people who were silent will be held to account. People will not forget when our blood was being spilled that these people were sat on the sidelines trying to protect their institutions when their institutions were actually set up in the first place to guide the Muslims, to help the Muslims, and moreover, to raise the plight of our people.
You know, Sheikh, what advice now in general to the Muslim public? We're not talking about leaders here, we're talking about everyday men and women. You know, what advice would you give them about their responsibility in forbidding this evil?
First of all, I think when the Muslim, or how should I say, religious elite, put it that way, and their response has to be seen also in a historical context, you know. For example, my brother here was talking about the younger sheikhs, okay? So it's just a generational thing going on here. The first phase of the Muslim community establishing itself in the West is one of, how I would say, nostalgia. Mm. Yeah, you know, I'm from Bangladesh. I come here. I am in an alien environment. I want to feel at home, so I gather with my other fellow Bangladeshis, and we end up building a mosque, which is basically a Bangladeshi religious and community center, you know? And the kind of ulama that they used to invite to come and lead their communities, or people from, let's say, Bangladesh or Pakistan or whatever, being conversant with the language of the environment that you're in was not important. What was important is maintaining your own language, you know, which also meant a certain type of disconnect with the environment that you have. And then the other generation started coming, second generation, third generation, where now their lingua franca is English, where their perspective is one now that is rooted in London or Manchester or Birmingham and what have you, and they require something more. They require now a kind of interfacing between Islam and the environment in which they are. And this is where things fall apart, because these older generation people are not in contact and not in touch with their environment and just cannot provide that particular leadership. And so the leadership now tends to sort of want to push towards the younger ulama. At the same time, however, their institutionalized structures tend to sort of put up resistance to this. My advice to the people and the young people and others in this time is to provide, is to fulfill your own leadership, is to take action, you know, and when you are doing this, you will attract the right people to lead you. You see, brave people lead to having brave leaders. Cowardly people tend to have cowardly or maybe even tyrannical leaders. You see, leaders who are not in touch in terms of not being fearless enough to risk sanctions being put on your centers and even the loss of your centers, you know, are not really leaders who are prepared to sacrifice. You see, and as the speakers, as the brother said, what's the name again? Brother Shaquille. You know, my dear brother Shaquille has said, you know, the people end up judging you, and you end up losing the very basis for your support, which ends up with, you know, you have an empty center with nothing
going
on.
I love that. Thank you so much, Sheikh. And thank you, Brother Shaquille, for joining us. And thank you at home. Unfortunately, this is all that we have time for today. Please join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by the late Ayatollah Khushvaqt. Please stay tuned.
پروردگار متعال انسان رو طوری ساخته و به وجود آورده که به تنهایی نمیتونه زندگی کنه.
Allah the Almighty has created humans in a way they cannot live alone. Rather, members of mankind should live together and each one take a job so that there will be a community which provides the needs of everyone. Thus, mankind appeals for a civil life in nature and cannot live individually. When people start living together, naturally there will be a problem of civil rights and regarding or disregarding human rights. History has always observed oppression of rights in different communities. The divine law has a solution for this problem and has planned a set of laws which can prevent from oppression of rights. The divine law says that if someone oppresses someone else's rights, he should compensate for that.
برای خدای متعال حقی قائل شده، برای انسان‌های دیگه حقی قائل شده، برای خود انسان نسبت به خودش حقی قائل شده.
In this framework of divine law, there are rights for everyone. God's rights upon humans, humans' rights upon each other, and even individual rights upon himself. Everyone should regard these rights, and if he oppresses them, he should pay back for it. Now, if God's servants do not make it to compensate for those wasted rights in this world, they will be forced to return those rights in the hereafter, and Allah will not escape these oppressions. But the interesting point is that we will have no money in the hereafter to pay for our debts or other people's rights. Therefore, either we should leave some of our good deeds to the other party or receive some of these bad deeds in case we do not have enough good deeds to pay for it. Now, Muslims who believe to surrender before the divine laws need to regard all these rights, and if it happens to oppress any of them, they shall try to compensate it in this world and not leave it to the hereafter. If there are financial rights we have oppressed or someone's reputation we have damaged, we shall compensate for all of them in this world. If it is not possible to return those rights in this world, then we have to wait to make them up in the hereafter. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by the late Ayatollah Khushbakht. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A United Nations body wrote to the British government to express very extreme concern about its failure to address structural, institutional, and systematic racism against people of African descent in Britain. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to figures that have led to warnings that racism, poverty and pressure on Britain's National Health Service must be tackled to prevent future fatalities, black babies in England are almost three times more likely to die than white babies after death rates surged in the last year. According to figures from the National Child Mortality Database, which gathers standardized data on the circumstances of children's deaths, the death rate for white infants has stayed steady at about 3 per 1,000 live births since 2020. But for black infants and black British babies, it has risen from just under 6 to almost 9 per 1,000. Infant death rates in the poorest neighborhoods rose to double those in the richest areas, where death rates actually fell. The mortality for Asian and Asian British babies also rose by 17%. The annual data shows overall child mortality increased again between 2022 and 2023, with widening inequalities between rich and poor areas and white and black communities. Most deaths of infants under the age of one were due to premature births. Karen Lloyd, the programme lead for the database and a professor of neonatal medicine at Bristol University, said many black and minority ethnic women were not registering their pregnancies early enough and the system needs to reach them in a better way. Karen Lloyd added, "There's an element of racism and there's a language barrier. Minority women often do not feel welcome. There's cultural incompetence and our clinical teams do not have the skills to understand different cultures." The figures showed that 50 more black babies died in the year to April 2023 than in the previous year. The UK's Labour Party noted that stark racial disparities in the changing mortality rates were scandalous. Annalise Dawes, the Shadow Women and Equalities Secretary, said, "Labour will work to close this shocking gap and to close racial disparities across our health service with a new Race Equality Act." The Race Equality Foundation described the figures as shocking but devastatingly not surprising. A spokesperson added, "We have known for some time that maternity care and mortality rates for black, Asian and minority ethnic women and children are far higher than for the rest of the population." The spokesperson added, "Without leadership in health institutions and a real desire for change, more infants will die." Website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Overall, the rate of deaths of Britain's black children aged from birth to 17 years old is now at its highest level since the database launched in April of 2019. The highest death rate for those over a year old continued to be for children aged between 15 and 17. There was also a second consecutive increase in death rates among babies under the age of one. Karen Lloyd, a professor of neonatal medicine at Bristol University, said, "If child mortality is going up, it means the health of our children is deteriorating." She added, "This is just the tip of the iceberg." In more than a quarter of the deaths reviewed in last year, expert panels identified achievable interventions that could reduce the risk of future child deaths. The proportion of deaths that could be avoided in future by doing things differently has increased. In 29% of all deaths reviewed, the children were or had been known to social care services, up from 24% in 2020. Karen Lloyd said, "There is evidence here that we can change this. We know that interventions can reduce child mortality and now need to implement things that we know work. She stated that was not happening currently because our health system are under extreme duress after a pandemic. A third of children are living in poverty and families are fighting to survive. A Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said maternity care must be the same high standard for everyone. The spokesperson added, in March, National Health Service England published its three-year plan for maternity and neonatal services, which sets out how it will make maternity and neonatal care safer, more personalised and more equitable for women, for babies and for families. The spokesperson for the Department of Health and Social Care added, NHS England has also published guidance for local maternity systems, supported by £6.8 million, focusing on actions to reduce disparities for women and babies from ethnic minorities and those living in the most deprived areas. The spokesperson added, alongside this, we have set up the Maternity Disparities Task Force, which brings together experts from across the health system, government departments and the voluntary sector to explore and consider evidence-based interventions to tackle maternal disparities. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. A United Nations body wrote to the British government to express very extreme concern about its failure to address structural, institutional and systematic racism against people of African descent in Britain. The United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent calls for an immediate and unconditional moratorium on the use of joint enterprise, warning it was leading to the disproportionate imprisonment of black adolescents. The working group said in a statement, "We have serious concerns about impunity and the failure to address racial disparities in the criminal justice system, deaths in police custody, joint enterprise convictions, and the dehumanizing nature of the stop-and-strip search." The United Nations added that Britain's austerity measures has exacerbated racism and racial discrimination for people of African descent, which had an adverse impact on their fundamental rights. Speaking at a press conference in London, Dominique Day, one of the five members of the United Nations Working Group, said, "I've never visited a country before where there is a culture of fear pervading in black communities, relating to a range of asylum, residency and policing issues. An entire community experiences constant and ongoing human rights violations as a routine and normalised part of their daily life." Officials said they had had a robust discussion about their preliminary research with the UK Equalities Minister, Kemi Badenoch. A 19-page summary of recommendations was sent to the British government on Friday. The working group noted the continuing fallout from the Windrush scandal. The Windrush scandal was a British political scandal that began in 2018 concerning people who were wrongly detained, denied legal rights, threatened with deportation, and in at least 83 cases wrongly deported from Britain by the Home Office.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. In this program, we discuss your curious questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Quran and the narrations of Holy Prophet, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have the pleasure to be with Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So we have another question today. I'll read it out for you. How can we upbring our children so that they can have positive impact on others and do not get influenced negatively?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is a very important question. I think there's a lot that can be said about this topic, that we want our children, the first part that you mentioned, second, which is that we aim and we want our children to be such that they don't get influenced by others.
Right.
And it's something we all understand, that you have certain children or even adults, right, that are very easily influenced by others, right?
Yeah.
So if somebody says something to them, they'll believe them. Or if a particular trend occurs or particular fashion occurs within society, they're very quickly adopted without thinking about it. They're very easily influenced by their friends, by the society, by what the media says. And society, or generally people, when you think about it, they actually count this as a very negative thing, right? Even sometimes, even you ask it themselves, you say, how do you perceive a person who is so easily influenced by others? They'll see that that's a very bad thing. It's a person who's doesn't have a strong ground, and it's not a positive thing at all. And so we want to raise our children in a way that they don't have this weakness where they are influenced by others so easily. So this is a very important point, and we need to really think about it. How do we raise kids whereby they can think about things before adopting them in their lives? Now, this can be at the theological, at the belief level, where we believe in everything that other people say, or we adopt the ideology that others have. Others means friends or society or movies and cartoons or anything. We don't adopt them without thinking about it. Or it can be related to actions as well. And the way we do things, where we are told by others, for example, to do certain things, peer pressure, for example, comes in this. Or sometimes even the apparent of certain things, the way we dress, the way we speak. I remember sometimes you find these youths, they go for a week, they travel for a week with their friends. When they come back, they're speaking exactly the way their friends speak.
Yeah.
Right? So easily influenced in the way they speak, in the way they dress, by others. So this is something where we understand it to be negative.
Mm-hmm.
And we should think about how we can bring about children that they are not like this.
Right.
On the other side, something that we find positive is that when we have children, and again, children as well as adults as well, who are not just influenced by others, but rather they are individuals who impact others. And obviously,
right,
over here, you can count this impact as a positive or negative. Sometimes you have influencers that will impact others in a negative way.
Right.
They will be sharing certain things, sharing ideas or sharing certain behaviors, and therefore impacting others often in a negative way. But you can have people who have a positive impact on others. Often they're leaders, often they're strong personalities, mentors, teachers, or just a leader personality type, basically, where they will be not just influenced by others, but rather they will influence others. They will have a positive
impact on others. Right. Well, this topic needs to be discussed more, and there's a lot more to talk about. There are several things while you were discussing that are coming into my mind, because in our culture, what happens where you get, I would say, influenced from the most are the Bollywood movies. Well, we'll discuss about that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Hey, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents. A priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. We're with Brother Miqdad, and we're discussing how to train your children so that they do not get influenced by others, rather they have a good impact on others. And Brother Miqdad is here to help us.
Yes, so you mentioned Bollywood and the influence that people have from TV generally, children as well as adults as well. So yes, this is a good example of how us adults as well as children, they get influenced in the way they think or even in the behavior by what they see, right? And so you want to build a strength in us, in our children, that we don't adopt the values or the ideas or the behavior of others without thinking about it.
Right.
I keep repeating this because I think it's important that we understand what we're trying to talk about. When we talk about influence, what does that mean? What does it mean, influence? And influence means that we don't adopt ideas and values and behavior of others without thinking about it. Because sometimes you really want to adopt. Let's say, for example, you see a scholar or you see a teacher or you hear about some of the traits of the Holy Prophet, for instance, and you want to adopt these. You want to be influenced by this. So being influenced generally is not neither negative or positive.
Right.
It's the idea of not doing it out of pure weakness, but rather doing it after a thought, after rationalism. So having this level of filter, and this is what we need to create in our children, a level of filter, a level of strength in able to think about things before adopting them. So when it comes from the Holy Prophet, when it comes from a scholar, then yes, please influence me. I'd love to be influenced by you. I'd love to adopt the way you think and the way you behave. And I want to be impacted by you, mm-hmm. right? And this is a positive thing. You want children to be influenced by their scholars, by the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. And so being influenced is a positive thing in this regard. And therefore, the point that we want to make over here is that when we talk about this, we talk about creating in our children, in ourselves, a filter, a strength to be able to rationalize and adopt and be influenced when mm-hmm. we want to.
Right.
You mentioned TV, so let's discuss this very quickly. TV is perhaps one of the biggest influences in today's world. And a practical tip right over here. If you want your children to be individuals who are not influenced, but rather have a positive impact, then reduce the amount of TV that they watch. Because TV, besides all the content that is being taught, besides all the different things that they're receiving on TV, the very fact of watching TV is telling your child that you need to copy, that you need to take in without thinking. Because TV doesn't allow thought, it doesn't allow action. It's just taking in.
Mm-hmm.
There's a quote by the president of the United States of America regarding this, that Hollywood is not entertainment, it's rather education, basically. In other words, we've been told that TV and being in front of the screen is not simply entertainment. It's actually education. It's telling me that, look, open your mouth and you'll be spoon-fed with different things. And so the very fact that you put TV for children, you're putting something on for the children, is actually teaching them that you are being spoon-fed of how to think and how to behave without the need for thinking about it. And this is why we often say that when you watch TV, always talk about it later on, always analyze it, always discuss it with your children. This is very important.
Right. Well, Brother Meghdad, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who recites the Quran before puberty has indeed been given wisdom in his childhood."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing with Brother Meghdad. And we're talking about how to train your children not to get influenced negatively, rather have a positive impact on others. So, Brother Meghdad, you were talking about TV. TV completely comes as if it is telling us to get spoon-fed and take in things.
So the practical point number one, if we really want to create children who have a positive impact on others and not just be influenced, is to train them to always have a filter, always create a filter for themselves before adopting something. And so when children have watched TV, when they've watched a movie, they've played a game, they've watched a cartoon, always take the opportunity over the dinner table, for example, to discuss it with them, to allow them to talk about it, but not just recount what they've seen, rather to analyze what they saw, right? To criticize it, to take the good from it and expose the evil from it.
Right.
And this conversation, slowly is training them to look, when I watch something, I have to analyze it. I have to think about it. I have to explore it, whether it was correct or was not correct.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just be watching 2-3 hours, 5-6 hours, 10 hours a week, and just taking in without analyzing it. So at every opportunity, discuss it with them. What do they watch? How do they find it? What was good about it? What was not correct about it? How can we improve it? Make them have a sort of filter. And what will happen is that you're creating within them not just this sense that I have to analyze, I have to think about it, I have to create a filter, not just accept everything that comes my way, right? This is the point, that I don't just take everything in, but rather have a filter. And so you create an attitude in them, attitude of having a filter, but also you're teaching them what kind of filter to have. You're teaching them, look, what is evil and what is good? You're teaching them, look, what you saw over here, it was good because of this reason. It was bad because of this reason. This is what Islam says about this particular point. This is what our ideology teaches us. This is how we see the world. And so you are not just creating an attitude in them of being able to analyze everything and not just taking in, but you're also teaching them how to analyze it. And this is how we analyze it. That when you watch this, for example, this particular words of this person in the cartoon, for example, or this particular behavior of this movie character, this was its fault. This was wrong about it. This is what we don't accept. And so when you're doing this, you're teaching them how to analyze it as well.
Right.
This is also valid for the news as well. When you watch news and you encourage your children to watch the news, same thing as well. You talk about the news. Don't just take everything in when it comes to the news. The
so
news
you're kind of developing that media literacy.
Exactly. So teach them how to teach them first to analyze, always be on a, not on the defensive, always have a filter on you. And what is this filter and how to filter things?
Do not let everything come in. Rather have that, create that strength of rationalization in your children so that they can be more practical in their lives. Thank you so much, Brother Meghdad, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Is
this is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.